Good afternoon, and welcome to today's cardiovascular maintenance endorsement project standard committee call. Please note, committee members will have an open line for the duration of today's call, so please use your mute button when you are not speaking or presenting to reduce background noise. Please make sure your computer speakers are turned down or off if you're joining us on the phone, and please do not place the call on hold. And now it is my pleasure to welcome you to today's meeting. Let's get started.
Thank you, Sean. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you again for dialing in for the post-meeting call. I know we have several key items that we want to get underway. Before I begin, I just wanted to introduce our staff here at NQF. My name is Wumi Isijola, project manager here. We have Lindsay Tai, the senior project manager. We have V. Luong, our project analyst, and we also have one of our senior directors, Karen Johnson, here on our side. But before we get started, we just want to take a roll call of the committee members who are currently on the line. So, V, could you start off first?
Hello, everyone. I'm going to start off the roll call now with Mary George.
Here.
Thomas Kotke.
Here.
Sana Al-Khatib.
I'm on the call.
Thank you. Carol Elred.
I'm here.
Thank you. Linda Briggs.
Here.
Jeffrey Burton. Leslie Cho.
Here.
Joseph Cleveland.
Present.
Thank you. Michael Crouch.
Here.
Elizabeth DeLong. Ted Gibbons?
On the call.
Thank you. Ellen Helga?
Here.
Thank you. Judd Hollander?
Here.
Thanks. Thomas James?
I'm here.
Thank you. Joel Mars?
Here.
Thanks. Christy Mitchell? George Philippines?
Here.
Thank you. Nick said he will not be attending the call. Jason Spangler?
Here.
Christine Stern?
Here.
Thank you. Henry Ting? And Mark Valentine will not be joining us today. And Mladen Vidovich?
I'm here, present.
Thank you.
Is there anyone who we didn't call or was not able to state their presence? Okay. Okay, with that being said, we do have a few measures that we'll be speaking to today. I know we had some follow-up from the developers, but before we get started, if in fact as a committee you would like to revote, you did receive voting instructions on how to do that, but in that case, Sean, could you speak to the voting instructions if in fact, the committee decides to vote?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Everyone should have received a link to enter the meeting today to ensure that you have voting privileges. If for some reason you did not use that link, don't worry. We are also tracking in the background. When a voting question appears on your screen, you will see boxes to the side of each one of the choices. You will simply click in the box next to the answer of your choice. If for some reason you do not see those boxes, please try to refresh your session by pressing F5 on your keyboard or Command-R for a Mac. Again, when these questions appear on the screen, they are for voting members only, and we will be tracking the votes in real time to make sure they have been calculated, and your information will be stored in the report so we do know who voted what. Back to you, Wumi.
Thank you. And if you do have questions, we do have the chat box available, so you can definitely use that as kind of your troubleshooting. So we're going to get right into measure 0643, cardiac rehabilitation patient referral from an outpatient setting.
I just want to step in and remind the audience one last time. If anyone has joined us on a tablet, you won't see the voting options on the tablet. You would need to be on a PC or a Mac. Sorry,
okay.
Back to you.
Thank you. Do we have any of the developers from ACC?
I got no email.
Amy, do they have open lines?
Would you like all lines open?
Yes, yeah, all right.
Okay.
This is Tom Kotke. I mean, I'm obviously not the developer, but if I, while we're waiting for them, I think this can be quick. The, if people recall where we choked on this was they proposed that stable angina be a criterion for cardiac rehab, and we said, well, gee, it doesn't seem to us that somebody should go through cardiac rehab on a yearly basis for stable angina. And then they had the words increasing, stable increasing or new angina, and it was an oxymoron. It can't be stable and increasing or stable and new at the same time. And so they've corrected the wording, which I think satisfies our, and they just, new or worsening angina that does not meet the criteria for unstable angina. And so I'm satisfied with that, and that was the only, hiccup in the whole thing. Cardiac rehab clearly reduces mortality. Referral rates are very low, and unless people refer, we don't know where the next roadblock is in the cascade to completing cardiac rehab.
Okay. Was there any other discussion around that?
My only concern, this is Leslie Cho. My only concern is as I stated before, I worry about, you know, having physicians, I know Tom's going to disagree, but having physicians be held accountable for inpatient and now the outpatient. And I realize the inpatient is more of a hospital measure and the outpatient is more of a physician measure. But to me, in my mind, there is no clear way if 1% gets an, you know, NMI, gets referred from cardiac rehab as an inpatient and then somehow goes to their outpatient doctor and their doctor doesn't check off the cardiac rehab, that outpatient doctor gets dinged. And I just feel like it's a, we're asking physicians, you know, for the same patient to be dinged twice, to have two encatchment, I think that's a little too much.
Are the lines open that the that the developers can comment on that?
Hello, this is Randy Thomas. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, you can hear me now? Okay, great. So, yeah, sorry, we were all trying to chime in, but I think our lines are not open. But,
sorry about that.
Yeah, and thanks, Tom and Leslie, for your comments. The, as Tom mentioned, our group submitted a revision to the wording of the criterion for the stable angina, and we really appreciate the input because I think this has made it a stronger statement and measure now. And as Tom mentioned, we've recommended revising the wording to include new or worsening symptoms that do not meet criteria for unstable angina, just to make it more clear. We borrowed this from the wording from the ACC-HA guidelines for stable ischemic heart disease, and I think we sent along the link to the guidelines and their class 1 indication for cardiac rehab. So you know, that's on that front. And Leslie, I'd like to address your concern too. Can you, and I want to make sure I'm understanding it correctly, your concern is that it would be too much to expect the physicians to refer from the outpatient setting?
No, if a patient, if one patient, let's say me, I have a heart attack and I go to the hospital, they refer me inpatient measure. This is 043, which passed, okay? Mm-hmm. I got referred for cardiac rehab.
Yep.
If I and show up to my outpatient physician's office and my outpatient physician does not refer me in the notes because he was running late or he was busy or whatever, I've already been referred, mind you, that physician gets dinged. I've been referred, you see, from inpatient.
Yeah, so good question.
Because you're taking two different databases. One is the Pinnacle Registry database, which is an outpatient registry database, right? One is the NCDR database.
The I'm not sure I follow the database question, but getting back to the original question, so if a patient has an MI in the hospital, they are referred to rehabilitation. The outpatient physician is not going to be held responsible for referring them because they've already been referred. The only thing that will happen is that patient, when they come in for an outpatient visit, it should be noted in the record if they have attended rehabilitation or not. If they have, then the measure specifies that patient is no longer, so to speak, they're not in the denominator. If the patient has not been referred, then that outpatient physician is responsible for referring them.
And this is Marjorie King, another measure developer. In practice, in private practice, where I've worked, we've done similar things for smoking cessation, where you have a place in the paper medical record or the electronic medical record, is the patient smoking, yes, no, so that you know whether you need to discuss it. A very similar data field could be set up in the outpatient record for has the patient gone to cardiac rehab, yes, no. That does not need to be done by the physician, but could be done by the med tech putting the patient in the room.
I know,
or by
but the
nurse.
Measure was developed using the Pinnacle Registry, correct?
No, the measure was tested using the Pinnacle Registry.
Right, but in order for, so what I'm saying is since the Pinnacle Registry and the NCDR Registry, which measure 0642 is off of, do not necessarily talk to each other, right?
But physicians and the nurses who put the patients in the room for an evaluation or an exam and the patients all talk to each other. So that's how the information.
But I feel like to me it seems a little redundant to hold a physician responsible when now that the chronic whatever is gone, you basically have an MI, PCI, and CABG patients being referred to bypass. Now, all of these patients will be referred, hopefully, in the inpatient setting. So the patients that were not referred in the inpatient setting is really the people you're trying to catch. It's a leftover measure for the people that were missed somehow on 0642.
Well, some of them are going to see the Steve Lichtman. I was down there in person. Hi, everybody. Some of them are going to be new to the outpatient physician. Some are going to be caught. That's correct.
I mean, I just think that, so if this outpatient goes to, I understand, listen, I am all for cardiac rehab. I want a cardiac rehab program. But my worry about something like this is when you keep on having sort of the same thing and you keep on asking physicians to do more thing, it's just a lot of, I don't know. There's a lot of, I think there's measure overload a little bit. I think one of the things we should also try to do is try to institute quality, but also try to do it in such a way that it's easy and doable for physicians and whatnot. So if a patient shows up to inpatient, gets discharged from inpatient and goes to a cardiology office or an internal medicine office, neither of them says cardiac rehab, who gets dinged?
I want to jump in here, Tom Kotke. You know, at the Washington session, we voted on a measure that would require primary care physicians to fill out or have their patients fill out a questionnaire that has no documented relationship to outcomes. And I think given the gap in cardiac rehab and the impact on outcomes, that asking cardiologists or other doctors to simply document that they asked a patient if they had been referred to cardiac rehab is not burdensome. And I think we ought to call the question and vote, because we're just going back and forth on this thing between Leslie and the proposers.
Thank you, Tom. Are there any other discussion around it before we go ahead and get into voting?
This is Henry Tang, and I'm sorry I joined late, but just so I can be clear in my own mind before I vote, is the performance of this measure, meaning compliance or defects, someone referred for cardiac rehab or not, is this already, as whoever spoke before me pointed out, already captured in the inpatient performance measure, and this would essentially capture the same defect and or compliance, or is it a separate measure that captures something different?
Well, for patients who weren't treated in the inpatient, it captures them, and we're starting to treat STEMIs as 24-hour admissions, so I can see in the next year or two that we treat STEMIs as outpatients.
I would beg to disagree with that statement, but the only patients this will capture would be outpatients who have PCI, who have PCI like not in the hospital, and outpatients who have their heart attack at home.
This would be outpatients who have stable angina, and that would be the main outpatient group that would be captured, outpatient with PCI as well, and then those who were not captured in the inpatient setting for the other indications.
It's the same patient population just to be captured in an outpatient setting as opposed to an inpatient setting.
Right, because, I mean, all these procedures and major acute coronary syndrome diagnoses are inpatient. They're not done as an outpatient. And when they are, maybe we consider a performance measure in the outpatient setting, as was suggested, that we would treat STEMIs as an outpatient. But for the outpatient measure, I thought our discussion in Washington, D.C. was patients with stable angina, that chronic stable angina patients would need referral to cardiac rehabilitation.
Yeah, but we don't have chronic. They've changed the words, Henry. They say new or increasing angina that does not meet the criterion of unstable. So stable angina, Randy needs to...
So that was a major point we had in Washington, D.C., because that's the group that's different for the inpatients, and we would need to clarify who makes that discretion that angina has changed.
Henry, you're not treating a particular patient. I mean, you're just setting the criteria, and, you know, it's in the note. I mean, we take the doctor's note all the time, even for diagnosis.
Right, so everybody with stable angina has to have a cardiac rehab referral within 12 months? Is that what they measure?
Stable angina is not in the measure anymore. It's new or increasing angina that does not meet the criteria of unstable.
How do we diagnose that? How do we make that the denominator, Tom? How do you actually, other than...
What the doctor writes down. I mean, it's the same way you make the diagnosis of unstable angina. Doctor writes down, patient has unstable angina, and we say, oh, okay, patient has unstable angina. I mean, how do you make the diagnosis of angina anyway? It's a very subjective...
Well, exactly, that's my point. It's very subjective of who's in the numerator and denominator then.
Yeah, and just to
tell you... It's up to the doctor to write it down.
Right. I agree. I completely agree with you, Tom.
Can I ask a couple of questions? This is Sana Al-Khatib. So if I remember correctly, at least part of the utilization of this measure is you would be using administrative claims data, and there's not a way to distinguish stable angina from an unstable angina from this new definition that you're using. The other thing that I would add is, assuming that we're able to find these patients, do you have a sense of the magnitude or the size of the patient population that would fulfill this measure, I mean, this description, because that really ties in very closely with the impact, the potential impact of this measure. What is the size of this population who don't have stable angina or unstable angina but are somewhat in between?
Well, this is Randy Thomas. What I can say, I don't have all the information to answer all of your questions, but I would say that it is very clear that right now, of all the patients who are seen in the inpatient setting, we'll talk about stable angina in a second, but all the patients in the inpatient setting who've had an event that qualifies them for cardiac rehabilitation, somewhere between 60% and 80% are referred, and somewhere between 30% and 40% actually enroll in cardiac rehabilitation. So if you're looking at the gap, and the scope of the problem is, I think we've already gone over, it's large. For the stable angina patients, there's not very much data that's been published on stable angina and referral to rehabilitation, nor enrollment. But the most of the gap information is available for the patients who've had the procedural and MI-related indications.
Okay. And with that being said, do we want to go ahead and vote? And this is based on the rewording of the specs that the developer presented.
Before we vote, this is Christy Mitchell. I just have one quick question. Can you remind me, is this measure currently in use? Is this, this measure currently in use?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that too well. You're asking if it's been, if the measure's in use currently? The measure is in use in the clinical outpatient registry from NCDER, and it is being used in various centers around the country as well, but it's the primary use in the registry is Pinnacle. It's also being used in the PQRS program through CMS.
Used by PQRS. Thank you.
Are there any other comments before we move on with the voting? Okay. And with that being said?
Given the new information presented, just voices from the committee, do you wish to revote or do you wish to maintain your original vote?
I say we revote. It's Leslie Cho.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm sorry, how are we supposed to vote?
Through the webinar, you'll have the option to vote, so go ahead and get to the first.
Okay.
So the voting side is currently shown on your screen. You'll see some empty boxes next to your choice A and B. Simply click in the box next to the answer of your choice, and your votes will be recorded.
This measure passed importance during the in-person meeting of the material change the developer submitted really was related to the scientific acceptability of the measure. So we'll ask you, we'll maintain the importance votes from the in-person meeting and start voting on scientific acceptability, reliability.
And the voting can start.
Are we voting on the inpatient measure right now?
We're voting on the cardiac rehabilitation patient referral from outpatient setting.
Okay.
Okay. You can begin voting on 2A, reliability.
I feel like I should point my mouse to the...
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to stop voting in just another second, so please leave your votes as they are.
Okay. So we have six that voted high.
No, we have one that voted high.
I'm sorry. We have one that voted high, 10 that voted moderate, and 5 that voted for low, 2 that voted for insufficient for criteria 2A reliability.
Okay.
So we'll move forward.
So we'll move forward and vote on 2B, validity.
Validity. And the voting can start now.
Okay, so right now we have 1 for high, 9 for moderate, 6 for low, and 2 for insufficient for criteria 2B on validity.
So we will move forward.
Okay, because the measure was voted down at validity during the in-person meeting, we have not had a discussion of feasibility, certainly other than what was just discussed now. Tom, do you have any comments to make about feasibility of 643?
Yeah, I mean, it for certain people with electronic health records that have a field, they'll be able to pull it electronically. Otherwise, it'll require chart review. But it seems to be no problem to me to be about feasibility.
Any other comments from the committee members or Carol?
This is Jason. I had a question about the validity vote. I thought it was between the 40 and 60% range.
It was. It was consensus not reached, but we'll continue moving forward.
Okay.
With the measure.
Got it. Thanks.
Any other comments about feasibility?
Oh. I have a question. It's Leslie Cho. Can you do this without a Pinnacle registry? Can the physicians, even if they're not part of Pinnacle, or do they have to buy Pinnacle in order to have this?
Absolutely. They can do it without Pinnacle. Our testing was done without Pinnacle. We identified centers from Pinnacle and other centers that participated in the feasibility and reliability testing.
How would they use it the outside Pinnacle and be able to capture the data that you need for the measure?
Some chart reviews, as we tested it. It was paper charts. It was chart reviews. It was similar to how you would test the measure for something like smoking cessation, aspirin use, other things that you can use it. You can use these measures outside of registries.
Well, but they have to be electronically specified. Electronically, that's one of our requirements within NQF. So, if you don't have access to a registry, how are you going to get
Is that in fact true that for all your current measure specs, everything has to be electronically specified?
Driving that way, but I'll let the NQF people address that.
And all I can say from the e-specification side, we are in the process of working through e-specification and have been working on this, but that's not part of the submission for this current endorsement. That's a separate process that we're working on still. But I would say that the goal is to have e-specification available not just in Pinnacle, but using any of the vendors that have electronic medical records.
Tom Kotke here. I think in the only electronic, there's only one electronic measure in the cardiovascular portfolio, but I'd like to hear from NQF about that because they made a big deal out of that when you're in Washington. This could be a hybrid measure. It's going to require chart review.
Are there any other?
Hey, Randy, this is Henry, can you help maybe explain the measure specification of how you plan to standardize or instruct physicians or cardiologists to categorize what is stable angina and what is not stable angina, and how that would be standard across cardiologists and practices?
Yeah, we use the same criteria that were published in the ECC-AHA guidelines for stable ischemic heart disease. That's where we got the wording from. And I think we've attached the reference for anybody who'd like to see that. So I admit with you and with Tom and others that just like many parts of medicine, it's not an exact science, but it's to identify the denominator, it's simply looking at those patients who are designated by the physician as having an episode of stable angina, or I'm sorry, a new episode of angina that meet those criteria. So I admit it's not a perfect science, but that's what we went by, the standard that's published in the ACCHA guidelines.
Randy, I apologize that I haven't read those guidelines and don't have them at the tip of my tongue, but can you just remind us what is not stable angina in terms of the change in duration, frequency, or pattern? How much of it would it be for a patient for me to categorize this as not stable angina? Just maybe at a high level.
That's not in the guideline.
Yeah, the guidelines.
If you decide, if you wrote, you saw a patient and say, he has new angina, and, but it's not unstable. I'm not going to send him off to angiography. Or his angina is a little worse, or it's increasing, any of those words. I mean, it's up to the doctor, just like with heart failure. You know, class 2 heart failure. What's class 2 heart failure?
So this is Judd, and this is sort of my area of research, although albeit in the emergency department and not cardiac rehab. And I could tell you that nowhere in the world is there a definition of angina that's reliable and reproducible, or unstable angina for that matter, because it assumes the clinician could tell what pain and what symptoms is cardiac versus not cardiac using clinical judgment alone. And so to me, it would seem the standard of care is if you believe somebody has unstable angina and they're in the outpatient setting, that patient shouldn't be going home. They should be going to the inpatient setting by definition. And so if you're not just looking at what happens following a hospitalization, there really shouldn't be situations where the outpatient doc in their office practice is seeing new unstable angina, STEMIs or NSTEMIs.
Yeah, Judd, this isn't about unstable. In fact, the wording says it's specifically about new or worsening angina that does not meet the criteria of unstable. So this doesn't have anything to do with unstable angina. I agree with you 100%. Unstable angina to go in the hospital, but this isn't about unstable angina.
Right, but I think by definition, albeit like I said, there's no real definition, new or progressive angina is what gets called unstable angina.
Not all the time.
Well, but there's not, I actually have serious concerns about the feasibility of this measure in terms of really capturing that patient population that falls between the stable angina and the unstable angina. Having been a cardiologist now for almost 14 years, and I know these guidelines that you're referring to are more recent, I am yet to see one note from a cardiologist that says, oh, the patient does not have stable angina and does not have unstable angina, but they fall in the middle. I just think that it's going to be impossible to define that patient population.
We're not doing an epidemiological study.
Yeah, I don't know if the measure developers are allowed to speak or not right now, but this is Marjorie King. I'd like to remind you that this measure is not just for unstable angina. That this measure was not just for stable angina, but it really was developed for patients with post-bypass MI, PCI, transplant, all the things that are valve surgery, all the things that the inpatient referral measure was developed for. This stable versus unstable angina is just sort of a side issue. This measure has been through approval. This is the third time now that it's been through an NQF group, and it just never hit us that stable angina wasn't well defined and that there may be the potential for the expectation of referral every year. But this measure is to catch those who fall through the cracks after their inpatient stay for when they see the doctors, for the doctor to just remember to refer the patient to outpatient cardiac rehab. So I'm sorry, I talk too much, but I feel pretty passionately too, having been a cardiologist for 30 years about this.
Okay.
That would be fine, Marjorie, but the biggest population denominator will be those with stable angina or not stable angina.
No, practically speaking, and again, we're in the metropolitan New York area, we get the majority of our referrals from from the physician's offices, not from the hospitals, and those are for all of those diagnoses, not for the stable angina. So,
I agree. Those diagnoses, but just from an epidemiologic standpoint, there are more and more patients with stable or not stable angina than those
Correct.
Who have vascularization procedure, surgical
mm-hmm.
or percutaneous.
Correct. No, I know. With recurrent.
We're not debating the portion of patients.
Right.
I mean, that has nothing to do with the measure, how many
right.
patients come from each category.
No, but that's in the denominator, and that's a very large portion of the denominator. And because that portion is so subjective, I'm not sure what this measure will actually tell us when a site's reporting 80% or 40% in terms of its performance. Because is that because they don't know how to diagnose not stable angina, or they're not knowing how to or is it really a gap in care that we're missing because we need to get patients to cardiac rehabilitation? Again, I believe in cardiac rehabilitation very much as everyone else does.
And so you could ask the same question about any procedures where you see a difference, tenfold difference in knee replacements.
Talking about any other procedure. We're talking about this measure, and we should focus on this measure, not class 2 heart failure or something else.
And just to interject, we're just talking on the criteria of feasibility at this point in time. So if there aren't any discussion around feasibility, we should just move forward to vote on that piece. If there aren't any questions or discussion surrounding that. Okay, so let's move forward with voting on feasibility. Voting begins now. Okay, and just as an FYI, this isn't a must-pass criteria, so done with.
Yes, so we have 1 that voted high, 5 that voted for moderate, 11 that voted for low, and 2 that voted for insufficient for the criteria on feasibility.
And so just to further explain Lumi's comment, this is not one of our must-pass criteria, so we'll consider discussion of the measure and the use and usability of the measure. When we come to a final vote on the overall recommendation for endorsement, we'll ask you to weigh the importance of the measure, the scientific acceptability, the feasibility and usability kind of all together using your own personal weighting, and come up with your overall recommendation for endorsement at that point in time. So with that said, Tom or Carol, do you have any comments on the use and usability of the measure?
Well, Tom here. It seems usable to me, and that's, I guess, what I'll put. That's the oral stick in the water. I don't think there are unintended negative consequences
that
are important.
Are there any other discussion around usability and use?
Can you hear me? This is Carol.
Yes.
Okay. My one concern about it was the difficulty for the physician to actually transmit the information, because so many of them have different EMRs and not all of them talk to one another. That was my one concern.
Thank you, Carol. Is there anyone else who wants to weigh in?
Yeah, Tom here. But this isn't necessarily an E measure.
Okay. If there aren't any other comments, we will move forward with voting on usability and use. Voting begins now.
For the usability and use criteria, 2 voted high, 5 voted moderate, 9 voted low, and 2 voted insufficient information.
Thank you. Okay. So we will now vote on the overall recommendation for endorsement. And as Lindsay mentioned, if there are any discussion around the overall measure as it relates to the 4 different criteria, that can take place now. If not, we can move forward with voting.
And voting.
Is there any discussion, Tom or Carol or any of the other committee members?
No, I don't think there's any new information.
Can I just add one voice to one side of the argument, because I think it's been important?
Okay.
As a clinician who sends patients to cardiac rehab, I'm not confused at all by the issue of their definition of angina. I think all they're getting at is if a patient is really unstable and requires advanced care, you probably shouldn't send them to cardiac rehab. And while we don't have hard definitions for that, I think most clinicians have a feel for that, that goes without saying. So to me, to not take this measure, which could be important in getting a large group that aren't going, because of that definition fog, to me it's not a big issue. So I just wanted to chime in with my two cents as just another clinician.
Thank you, Henry. Is
that was George.
Else? Oh, I'm sorry. Is there anyone else? Okay. With that being said, we will vote on the overall suitability for endorsement. Voting begins now.
So in conclusion, for overall suitability of endorsement, 8 voted yes and 11 voted no.
Okay, so 42% voted yes, which falls within our gray zone for consensus not reached. We will put the measure out as consensus not reached and solicit comments on this measure in particular from those who are commenting, provide that information back to you all at the end of the comment period, and have another discussion then.
Thank you. Okay, and with that, we will move forward with measure 2379, adherence to antiplatelet therapy after stent implementation. Do we have any of the developers from CMS on the line?
Hello, this is Kyle Campbell from FMQAI. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm available.
Okay, great. So if you want to just provide the findings that you presented to the committee.
Sure. So at the steering committee meeting on April 21st in D.C., members had concerns about the inclusions of patients receiving bare metal stents without an acute coronary syndrome indication. And so based on those concerns, we have revised the measure to exclude BMS procedures without an indication for ACS. And we provided on May 2nd a memo that summarizes our approach to the exclusion, the suggested revisions to the measure specification, which are in red text, and the revised testing results. And I can see that that memo is up on the screen now. I would just ask if the committee would like me to walk through this memo or whether you'd prefer to just ask questions.
I think it would be good for you to walk through it. Thanks, Kyle.
Okay, sure. So the first question or the first consideration is how would we identify bare metal stents versus drug-eluting stents in the administrative claims data? So we did a review of coding, and you can see in the coding table the type of stent, the code system, and the code along with the description. And we did have two cardiologists on our team review the codes. So the first 5 codes represent codes that identify bare metal stent, and the next 5 codes represent codes that are used to identify drug-eluting stents. We're also aware that starting in January 1st, 2013, that new CPT and HCPCS codes have been created for billing stent procedures. And in the memo, we've included those codes in the specification. But for our test data set, which looked at claims between 2010 to 2012, these are the codes we use for stent identification. The second issue is that next you need to identify patients with an acute coronary syndrome, and that was determined based on a presence of an ICD-9 code of either 410 or 411, any of the diagnostic code fields in Part A or Part B. And the detailed descriptions for that can also be found in the appendix. And again, those were reviewed by 2 cardiologists on our team. The next issue that we considered was how to associate the acute coronary syndrome diagnosis with the stent claims. And we did that through the dates. So if the date of the acute coronary syndrome claim encompassed the date of the stent procedure, then the ACS diagnosis was considered to be associated with the stent. Otherwise, the stent was considered to be for a non-ACS indication, and this is generally consistent with the identification of ACS diagnosis for stent procedures that we identified in the literature, and there's a citation included. So in summary, how did we exclude bare metal stent placement for non-ACS indications? Essentially what we did was any claim that had a code listed in the table below in 4 without a corresponding ACS claim with that overlapping period were excluded from the data set. And number 5, then, we looked at what the impact of the proposed exclusion on the measure rates and scientific acceptability were. So the proposed exclusion resulted in a decrease in approximately 13.6% of individuals in the measure denominator in our 10-state sample, and for our ACO data sample, about 12%. The mean measure rate increased about 0.01 to 0.02 across each level measured, and we still did have a gap in performance with a mean rate of approximately 0.78, remembering that 0.8 is the critical threshold, and you would expect that patients would be closer to 1. The variation in performance remains 0.06 to 0.14 between the 10th and 90th percentiles across all levels that we measured, and the reliability based on our signal-to-noise analysis remains very high across all levels of measurement, and that's included in Appendix B. So for number 6, based on the review, what are the final recommendations and conclusion for the steering committee? We recommend a revision to the specifications to add this exclusion that would remove these patients from the measure population. And the proposed revision to the specifications are shown in red. So where you see the red text, that's where the measure specifications have been revised. So the revised measure description now essentially reads average proportion of days covered for individuals with antiplatelet therapy during 12 months following implantation of a coronary artery drug-eluting stent, regardless of indication, or bare metal stent for acute coronary syndrome. And down at the bottom, for the denominator exclusion, if you just scroll down, still outside my screen. I don't know if you can see it. The placements of a coronary artery bare metal stent for non-ACS indication are excluded. And then we retained, obviously, our exclusion for individuals with contraindications to receiving antiplatelet therapy. And the two coding sets are here. The first Excel table just shows the revised codes in 2013 for bare metal stent and drug-eluting stent. And the second table shows the ICD-9 codes along with the ICD-10 crosswalk to identify acute coronary syndrome. And then if you scroll on, basically we provided the committee with the revised testing results, the meaningful differences in performance, so you can see the distribution at each of the levels. And then the last page, last couple pages provide the revised reliability scores based on the new measure definition.
Thank you, Kyle. Is there any discussion around the revised specification from the committee?
Okay. This is Linda Briggs. I think that the people that proposed the measure did a really nice job of going back and making modifications to try to exclude a group of patients that we had concerns about. However, the biggest concern that we had was that this measure is not completely parallel and congruent with the recommendations for acute coronary syndrome patients. My point is that in the unstable angina non-STEMI guidelines, while it does recommend that anyone that has unstable angina non-STEMI with a PCI have a P2Y12 for greater than or equal to 12 months, it also says, particularly in the footnote there, that if the risk of morbidity secondary to bleeding is greater than the benefits, then early discontinuation should be considered, and it's a 1C recommendation on page 221 of those guidelines. So sometimes people, interventionalists, will choose bare metal stents specifically because people may be anticipating surgery or they know that the patient has a history, and upfront you would catch those people in contraindications. But if someone develops a contraindication potentially during the time that the stents are being or the drugs are being given, I'm concerned about whether we're capturing that contraindication within that 12-month period. And also those people that, again, that you've sort of planned, that they don't really have a contraindication, but maybe they have surgery that's planned, et cetera.
Any comments?
Sure, Judge. Correct me if I'm wrong. And maybe I'm confusing the measures now that it's a couple weeks later. But wasn't our concern on this measure a large part related to whether it's actually adherence being measured? Or whether just different prescription plans may provide different coverage for the medications, and it may have nothing to do with whether the patient actually takes them.
We did have a concern about adherence, but one of the larger arguments was related to the fact that bare metal stents have a different recommendation than DES stents. The bare metal stents in every recommendation say up to 12 months. It doesn't say greater than or equal to 12 months as the drug-eluting stents do. So it's people would still be, physicians would still be well within the guidelines to discontinue during that 12-month period for a patient who has a bare metal stent. They would be fully within the guidelines, but they could get dinged based on the measurement in this particular measure.
Right. So I agree that that's true, but then I guess maybe I'm throwing out an additional concern for this conversation. And my concern is that if you happen to be in a prescription plan, which, of course, your physician doesn't control what your pharmacy plan is, where every 2 months or 3 months they send you your drugs without you having to renew, you're going to be considered adherent whether or not you actually ever take the drugs. And so those patients will do well, but the physician doesn't control who those are. And if you need to go every month and pay for it out of your own pocket, well, the physician can't get you the drugs if they cost money and you don't have money. So it's hard to say the physician's responsible for that. It's one thing if you ask, does the physician write the prescription when you're seen? But to me, this is going to be, you know, significantly driven by a patient's income and insurance plan, and the provider really doesn't control that at all.
So this is Kyle Campbell for the measure developer again. Maybe the best thing to do would be to address the guideline issue first and then move to the issue with regard to the way the measure actually measures adherence. As far as the guideline goes, the guideline on page 25 from Levine basically outlines that patients with a bare metal stent or drug-eluting stent that have an ACS indication should be given the P2Y12 for at least 12 months. It extends for drug-eluting stents for non-ACS indications. And then the third guideline is BMS for a non-ACS indication, which is the population that we're excluding, should be given for a minimum of 1 month and ideally up to 12 months. And what the committee, my understanding of what the committee asked us to do was to take out that population of patients receiving elective BMS such that we wouldn't be penalizing physicians or health plans if the drug was discontinued earlier than 12 months. As far as the contraindication issue, the contraindication, we look the entire 24-month measurement period. So you have a 12-month identification period to identify the index event for the stent, and then the following 12 months to look at the actual drug identification. If a patient has a contraindication at any time during that 24-month period, they are out of the measure denominator. So from that perspective, I do believe we are accounting for patients that will have any sort of bleed during the follow-up period. In terms of the adherence question, this measure is consistent with all the other endorsed measures in the NQF portfolio that measure medication adherence, and we recognize that the filling of claims is a proxy for adherence, but it has shown to be a valid proxy in the literature. We do concede that if the steering committee feels strongly about the levels of measurement, we are willing to drop the measurement at the physician group level and only retain the measure at the state, the accountable care organization, and the health plan level.
So I would comment that I would strongly favor that because I think your health plan does determine whether you're going to get your medications. The individual physicians may not, or the physician groups may not. So I want to make sure we hold the correct people accountable.
This is Tom James, being one of those correct people being held accountable. So I would agree with that, although I do know as a practicing physician that when I order the most expensive drug, people are less likely to fill it unless they've got top-end insurance. So there are things that physicians can do in proper pharmaceutical selection, but it still is one that health plans should be held accountable for.
Are there any other comments with regards to the specs that were presented today? Okay, and with that being said, we will...
Okay, so because the developers presented the option of either specifying the measure at the clinician group level and above or omitting that, we do need to just clarify when we move into a vote what the committee is voting on. So is the measure without the level of analysis at the clinician group level or including the analysis at the clinician group level?
This is Linda. I would propose if this measure goes forward that it only be at the state and ACO level, not the individual provider level.
Is there any disagreement with that?
You may add health plan, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Health plan also, just absent the level of analysis at the clinician group level.
I'd be happy with that.
Okay. Hearing no disagreement, we'll move forward with voting on the measure, keeping in mind that we'll be voting for this. The lowest level of analysis will be at the individual health plan level, and then with the exclusion related to bare metal stents that Kyle has detailed.
Can I ask a question about this before we vote?
Sure.
Is there any way to gather data on the individual level but only report it at the levels that are higher, as you guys mentioned? Because let me give you just another side, and I don't feel strongly about this. If I just had a patient of mine get a drug-eluting stent, and I know that it's really important that they stay on aspirin and clopidogrel for 12 months, one of the most important things I do at their follow-up visits is query them about aspirin and clopidogrel, and try to get to the fact that they're not taking it, their insurance company's no good, and then make every effort I can to help them. That's sort of why they're following up with me. It's one of the reasons. So it might be interesting to find out if within the same ACO or insurance group, some clinicians are doing a better job of this than others. I wouldn't like it being reported, but it might be interesting data, so I'm wondering if it can be gathered.
So this is Kyle Campbell for the measure developer again. It certainly can be gathered because it's all available in the administrative data, and likely if this measure were implemented at the ACO level or the health plan level, part of the intervention, any quality improvement intervention that a health plan might undertake would involve, prescribing physician and providing, you know, data in that regard, so that they were aware of what the adherence, for their patients were.
I mean, looking 2 years down the road, it would be interesting if it turned out that within the same ACO, some physicians had a very, very high rating and some very low that could not be explained by the other variables. So I'm glad to hear that.
Okay. We'll move forward with the reliability voting. Voting begins now. And for the criteria 2A voting results, 2 voted high, 15 voted moderate, 0 voted low, and 1 voted insufficient for reliability.
We'll move forward with validity. Is there any discussion around that?
Other than what's already been said?
Okay. So we'll move forward with the voting.
And voting starts now. So in conclusion, for criteria 2B for validity, 1 voted high, 15 voted moderate, 1 voted low, and 1 voted for insufficient.
Thank you.
Any discussion of the feasibility of the measure? Yeah. Do we have Jeff Burton or Linda Briggs? Any comments?
This is Linda. I don't have any problems with the feasibility. Again, my concern is related to the bare metal stents in patients, period, being included here because the recommendation is up to 12 months, not including 12 months.
Okay. Anyone else with comments about the data source, if it's generated during care and if the data collection strategy can be implemented? Just for purposes of us writing the report, is your silence to mean that you all agree that the data is generated during care, it's in electronic sources, and the strategy can be implemented?
Is that a yes?
Yes.
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 Okay. Great. Just want to make sure we have people on the line. And with that being said, we will move forward with voting for feasibility. Starts now.
Feasibility, 5 voted high and 13 voted moderate.
Okay. Thank you. And then we'll move on to usability and use. Jeff or Linda, do you have any comments?
No additional comments at this time.
Okay.
Okay. So voting.
Any committee members with any comments?
Okay, and with that being said, we'll move forward with voting for usability and use. Voting starts now. Okay.
So for usability and use, 0 voted high, 17 voted moderate, 1 voted low.
Okay.
And 0 voted insufficient information. Okay.
So now we're going to vote on the overall suitability for endorsement, keeping in mind the discussion for the revised specs of the measure. Are there any comments before we vote?
Okay. So with that being said, we will vote now.
Okay, so in conclusion, for overall suitability for endorsement, 16 voted yes and 1 voted no.
Thank you. So this measure will be recommended for endorsement. Thank you, Kyle, for joining us. And with that being said, we will move forward to measure 2452, PCI, post-procedural optimal medical therapy by ACC. Is there anyone on the call?
Do we have any developers from ACC to speak to what was submitted over email?
Yes, this is Jensen, ACC staff.
Hi, Jensen.
So what, remind me again, what did you want me to speak to? Because this obviously can get quite technical, the coding discussion. Were there specific issues you had? We can field questions. I don't know if we have to go through, are we going through the whole, this process-wise, are we going through the whole importance, reliability and validity testing and everything, or?
No, this is Lindsay. I'll jump in. So the issue really is that there was a lot of confusion about the differences between measures 2452 and 0964 at the meeting. You all were saying that they were identical except for the level of analysis, and then in email follow-up with our staff, you highlighted some differences between the two measures, though noting that they were harmonized. So if you could just walk us through the differences between the two measures, because we'd like to give the committee the opportunity to understand why you believe there need to be two measures and then potentially re-vote if they agree with your justification or ask you to harmonize the measures if they don't agree with your justification.
Okay.
And by harmonizing combine, it was that whole discussion that we had.
Okay. So the harmonization piece will probably happen second. I think just the first piece, we're on the same page what both measures are. So 2452 is the optimal care measure, and then you're talking about that one and the 954, right? So those two measures look very similar, but they're slightly different. Those are the two measures you're referring to, right?
Correct.
Okay. So that one of them obviously is the individual physician level, and then which is 2452. And then 954 is the facility level. So the facility level measure has already been endorsed at NQF. And that one, I think the issue came into exclusions, if I'm correct, and the difference between the exclusions and exceptions. So the measures are aligned, but the issue being, and we tried to articulate it in the email, but I'll try to keep it as simple as I can, but the issue being, the facility level exclusions are, as you know, so patients who expired, they died, left AMA, medical advice, they also patients discharged to hospice. All those are exclusions for the, you know, for the facility level. And when we treat exclusions and the 954 measure, exclusions are, we treat those as exceptions, and those actually are contraindicated patients are actually considered a performance met. The thought being that, again, this is 954, the thought being that when you're contraindicated, the thought is it should still be performance met, and that was the facility level. Now, at the individual patient, individual physician level, again, that's a different Stewart, ACCHA, PCPI. That one, as you can see, the notes show that the exclusions are actually removed from the denominator, so therefore the denominator population slightly shrunk. Now, having said that, those are really the only key differences. I know in the group at the meeting there was some concern that this is a very, very different measure. It really is the same meds. All those meds have been harmonized. I won't go through all the medications unless you want me to, but all the medications are the same, aspirin, P2Y12, statins. Those are all the same in the denominator. Again, it's just how you calculate the exclusions and exceptions are slightly different.
Yeah, so to be clear, Jensen, the issue that was raised was that the measures are extremely similar, and we wanted to understand what the justification for having two measures specified at different levels of analysis were versus having one measure that you were able to calculate at both levels of analysis.
Right, so at the hospital level, that one obviously is already endorsed, and the individual physician level is not yet, it's up for discussion still. So physicians obviously aren't always nested in hospitals. That can lead to confusion.
there are some operational issues in the individual physician level that are slightly different than the hospital level, A. B, the testing, while it's at similar sources, you know, the CAF registry, again, the testing provided was different. And this is, again, more, I think, operational, that the steward for the inpatient hospital level is ACC only. The outpatient's ACC, HAP, CPI. So while it might seem kind of easy to merge, operations is a little tricky because they're both, while they appear very similar, and I discussed all the similarities, the meds, all that is harmonized because those are three based on the guidelines and everything. I won't go through all that. They are very, very, very similar. It's just operationally they are carried across differently. It's similar to other measures that we have in the portfolio. I know we talked about the rehab measure quite extensively, so I won't bring that up. Using it only as a corollary that you have an in and out patient, so they're two different, again, they're different in that case, they're different populations, but yet they're somewhat similar. So I know we're not going to talk about harmonization on that measure given the outpatient measure has failed, but again, it's more for the operations of putting these measures forward. And currently the facility level measure is, as we know, the usability of the measures, again, are slightly different. So I can go through all of them if you want me to, but I think they are noted in the application, the usability of these two measures.
So, Jensen, this is Karen Johnson. Just a question for you. In measure 2452, the patients who might be excluded from that measure, the clinician level measure, would those same patients be excluded from the facility level measure, or could you be excluding different patients because the specifications are different?
You could potentially be excluding different people. So 245, that was, again, that one is the physician level measure, just so everybody's on the same page. That's a physician level measure. So patients who expired, patients who left AMA, patients discharged in hospice and discharged acute care hospital. In terms of the calculation for the individual physician level, that currently means that you're being removed from the denominator, meaning you're shrinking the eligible population.
So this is Judd. I have a question, and I've heard what you said, but I guess if I try and take the approach that every measure is work, what you haven't done is give me a compelling reason that these can't be handled under one measure rather than two different measures. Like, I don't see a reason why they can't be perfectly harmonized and put together and reported at two different levels. I do understand that there's, you know, slightly different stewardship for the measures, but I don't think that's a compelling reason to have hospitals or physicians report differently. Personally, I'd rather see people work out the stewardship politics, for lack of a better word, rather than have a separate measure because of it, if it can all be done under one measure.
Any other comments from the committee? Does the committee like to re-vote on this measure, given the information presented today?
Excuse me. This is Sam Tierney with the PCPI. Could I make a comment?
Sure.
Thank you. I just wanted to sort of related to the stewardship issues. I know that probably across NQF staff's portfolio of measures, this issue has come up, I imagine, a number of times, where there is a measure at the facility level that is essentially measuring the same thing as the measure at the physician level. I know, having developed a number of physician level measures over the years, that we certainly have seen measures that are very similar to ours at the facility level, and oftentimes those are both considered for endorsement, and those are both considered different enough to get endorsed. So I guess my question to NQF staff is, how would you normally advise a committee when you have two similar measures that are addressing the sort of the same patient population and the same measure focus, but they are different stewards? In most instances that I'm aware of, they are different stewards entirely, and this is sort of a unique situation in that ACC is involved in both the facility and the physician level measure, but I think it would be helpful to consider this as you've considered other measures where the situation is essentially the same.
And the only thing I would add, if I can, this is Jensen again, I'm sorry to add in. I know we're past your time. The only thing I add is, I know operationally I hear you, Dr. Hollander, if I heard correctly, and others, But I think the challenge is, one thing I'd articulate is that the ACCHA-PCPI measure has a measure calculation that is slightly different than the other measures, the 954 and other measures. So if we were to harmonize this measure, this would actually impact various other measures. I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing. It's just there are some other implications, because if we harmonize it completely, the measure calculation would have to be the exact same. And so, again, while we've argued they're very similar, there was a little bit of slight differences. The medications and all that are the same. But and thanks, Sam, for chiming in as well. I think I don't know if NQF staff have any other input in that regard. I don't think I believe this has creeped up before in past projects.
So Jensen, can I ask you one question? It's Judd again. And I guess fundamentally, I would want to be convinced that having two separate measures is going to improve quality of care. And so I would ask you to make the argument for the committee, because, right, that's what it's all about, is how are we going to improve quality of care. And if we break it down and you could give us a compelling argument that having two separate measures is going to make it better for patients, then it would be easy to handle.
This is Sam Tierney again. I think that's an important question, but I think I would maybe reframe it a little bit to say, do you think that this process is important to measure at the physician level? Do you think that this could help differentiate quality across providers at the physician level? And if the answer is yes, then I would argue that you should endorse the physician level measure related to this. But if the thinking of the committee is more that this is really more appropriate at the facility level, then that seems like that would help make the decision for you. But I think the stewardship issue seems to be sort of getting in the way, but I see this as no different than other measures, for example, aspirin at arrival for AMI, where there's a facility level measure and there's a physician level measure. And I know that's sort of tapped out, so that maybe not the best example, but I think it seems to be the stewardship issue that's confusing the decision making here. But I guess, again, I would say, to answer the question of whether or not you believe a physician, this is a process of care that would that you'd be able to differentiate quality across physician providers.
Tom Kotke here. It's possible that a physician who's operating in several hospitals but only performs a small proportion of the total procedures in any hospital could be performing quite poorly, but not be detected under the hospital measure.
So just so I answer, since I think part of that question was directed at my comments, I'm a firm believer that measuring at the physician level is important, but I'm also a firm believer that as we put out more measures, we should try and be make it as efficient as possible for the people completing the data forms.
Okay, this is Lindsay from NQF, so I'll just jump in on the process points here. So certainly we're asking the committee to evaluate the measures independently, so 0964 at the facility level and 2452 at the clinician level. The conversation then, if both measures are deemed to meet the criteria, would be, do we need both of these measures? Are they harmonized to the greatest extent possible? And the committee can make a choice to, at that point, only move one of the measures forward for endorsement, recommend to the developers to combine the measures, look for additional areas of harmonization of the measures, but maintain them as separate. We have seen this in the past. We had a measure that was stewarded by the American College of Surgeons and another one by CDC. The developers worked together to combine the measures into one at the behest of the committee. So there is precedent for this. It's not something that we see particularly often. But that is kind of within the purview of the steering committee's recommendation. So in evaluating 2452, we do want to understand if it, as a measure standalone, meets the NQF endorsement criteria. And if the committee deems that it does, then we want to consider it head-to-head with 964 to see if it makes sense to have two measures, combine them, or further harmonize.
Lindsay, this is Henry. I think Judd is maybe asking a question about, in our prior experience then, can anyone, either developers, ACC, CMS, or NQF shed light on when measures like this happen, does having a separate sort of a hospital level as well as a physician level measure actually make care better? Or is one sufficient And we're talking about sort of measuring at several different levels of granularity that would, you know, create a lot of measures and a lot of work and effort to collect those measures, but not really make care better. From an attribution standpoint of making care better, was there one with a dominant effect, or do these two measures have equal important impact on making care better for our patients and populations?
This Tom James, could I jump in just to talk about that particular concept? That typically that payers, and I'll speak for the commercial and Medicaid side, will use accountability measures that are in parallel between the hospital side and the physician side, so that there it really is an attempt to try to create synergies as far as the incentives go.
Okay, I don't know that we can answer the question about whether one level of analysis is better than the other per se, but I do just want to reiterate that we want to look at 2452 in isolation to see whether or not it meets the evaluation criteria. As a reminder, the committee's final vote for endorsement on this was yes 11, no 11, so we were split 50-50. We wanted to use this opportunity to have further conversation to see if the committee wanted to change their vote based on any new information or additional time to marinate on this. The conversation is still sounding pretty split at this point. The measure was voted consensus not reached. We're happy to put it out for comment at consensus not reached and then revisit these issues after comment with input from NQF members and the public, unless there's a motion from the committee to revote on 2452 at this point in time. Hearing nothing, we'll leave it as it is and plan to revisit this after the comment period once we've gotten a little bit more insight from a broader group of stakeholders. Thank you, everyone from the developer side who joined us for that discussion, and we can talk offline if you have any questions.
Sure. Okay, so this is Karen Johnson here. I'm standing in for Reva today. She is cruising somewhere in the Atlantic, so kudos to her while we're trying to figure these CV measures out. We have measures 0535 and 0536 on the agenda today, mainly just to clear up a misunderstanding that came through in the in-person meeting. So just to recap those measures very quickly, those were the 30-day all-cause risk standardized mortality rates for PCPI, and there were two different measures with STEMI and without STEMI. So two different measures looking at post-PCI mortality. In the in-person meeting, the developer described the 30-day mortality measure as being I don't know what the right word is, as being a little bit different than the in-hospital mortality measure by saying that the 30-day all-cause mortality measure only looked at patients who did not die in the hospital. In fact, that wasn't exactly a correct representation of those measures. The 30-day all-cause looked at mortality from PCI up to 30 days. So the two 30-day mortality measures include those who died in the hospital as well as those who died outside the hospital but within 30 days. So we just wanted to make sure that that was clear to everyone, first of all, just because there was a little bit of misunderstanding in the in-person meeting. So let me stop there and see if there's any question, and then we'll go on to talk very briefly about related and competing issues. No question. Okay. So basically what we have here with 0535 and 0536, as well as pulling from, not from memory, I looked it up, 0133, the in-hospital mortality measure, what we have are three measures basically looking at post-PCI mortality. So In NQF speak, that's what we call competing measures. So similar to what you discussed before, we just want to have a discussion about whether we really need to have three different mortality measures for the same condition. So, again, the developers, and I think they're on the line so they could respond to this, but one question might be, is there a reason, a good reason, to have two different 30-day PCI mortality measures, one STEMI, one non-STEMI, given that they don't split those out for the in-hospital measure? And then also, kind of related, is there a reason to have an in-hospital measure and a 30-day measure that includes the in-hospital deaths? So maybe we could ask the developer to discreet briefly as to why they feel the need to have three different measures of what is conceptually the same thing, again, post-PCI mortality, and then we'll open up discussion.
So this is Jeff DeCurtis, representing ACC today on behalf of this measure. And again, apologize for the confusion that there was about whether or not in-hospital mortalities were excluded from the 30-day measures. To answer your question specifically, the first question is whether, you know, why you need to have the stratified 30-day mortality measures. And, you know, there was a lot of discussion in the evolution of this particular measure set as to whether or not that was necessary, and then also whether or not those were the appropriate groups to stratify to. In this case, the consensus from the measure development team, which included many members from the ACC and outside, was that it was reasonable to stratify the measure into these two populations because their expected outcomes were so different. In keeping with that, it also follows the protocols and methodology that had been adopted by Massachusetts in the MASDAQ experience in their public reporting of PCI outcomes that used similar registry data. So the reason why it evolved differently than the in-hospital measure has more to do with I think, time and different groups that were developing these measures separately and at different points in time. But I do think that there is some justification or good justification as to why you would want to do that. I think that the differences in the populations in the expected mortality only increases over time. So there's perhaps a small justification for why you would do it for the 30-day versus the in-hospital mortality measures. But I think more than anything else, it reflects differences in decision-making as to key decisions and by two different groups developing the measures. The second piece is why one might want in-hospital measure as well as a 30-day measure. I think that has more to do with what the differences between an optimal measure and what is a practical measure, and recognizing the fact that they may have complementary roles. And specifically, when I say that, if you look at the ACC-AHA guidelines for development of outcomes measures for public reporting, it specifically states that a good measure should have a fixed time period for evaluation, and that measures that use in-hospital evaluation or in-hospital timeframes alone may be prone to errors on the basis of differences in discharge and events that occur post-discharge. So they do recommend a fixed time frame. So the 30-day measures have adhered to that and recommend that. The downside of that is that it's somewhat difficult to implement such a measure, and particularly to implement it in a timely fashion, given the difficulty of assessing outcomes at 30 days or any time post-discharge. So the in-hospital mortality measure is more of a not a compromise, but a different approach, or prioritizes things differently such that it does not meet the criteria of having a fixed period for evaluation, but it is incredibly feasible in that hospitals can report their in-hospital mortality without any additional resources being dedicated. So, again, I think that in that sense, it's much more timely in that this data can be aggregated much more rapidly than waiting around for an independent death index data to be become available. So the measures are overlapping in some sense, but we do feel that the complementary nature of them overwhelms the downsides to them being overlapping. So I'll leave it at that and open for questions.
Are there any questions or discussion?
So being a presenter for 535, I would agree with Jephtha, because I think the feasibility and particularly usability of an inpatient versus 30-day measure would be different because factors that determine survival at in hospital could be very, very different than factors that determine survival at 30 days. So there would be different actions that a practice or physician could take. And the other thing, as Jephtha pointed out, that to separate STEMIs and shock versus non-STEMI and shock, I think is also important, because if you clump them all together, you're going to get an average number, whereas we know for 535, which is without shock and without STEMI, those mortality rates are actually quite low compared to the patients with STEMI and with shock.
Any other discussion? George, do you have anything to add? Or?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So what we're going to do now is open it up for member and public commenting. Amy, could you make sure that all lines are open?
Yes, ma'am, all lines are open.
Anyone with any comments, please feel free to speak up.
Okay. So thank you again all for participating in this call. So next steps, we will be incorporating a lot of the discussion today as well as from the two-day meeting into our draft report, which will go up for public commenting on May 27th. We will be in touch if, in fact, we do receive comments to the developers as well as to the committee for response. And if you do have any questions or concerns, please do let us know. Okay, and with that being said, we will adjourn early. Thank you again for participating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes today's call. Thank you, and you may now disconnect.